This is Seattle's Morning News. The state of Washington has now sued the Trump administration to block use of Navy money for his border wall because some of that Navy money is coming from facilities here. And to talk about it, here is Governor Jay Inslee. Governor, what are the chances of winning this lawsuit?
I think our chances are excellent to yet again prevent Donald Trump from acting illegally to disadvantage our ability to protect the people of the state of Washington. This is yet another one of those cases. And so far, now there have been 21 cases resolved, and the state of Washington has defeated Donald Trump in all 21 of those cases. That's an amazing record of success. And the reason for that is that he has continually tried to avoid the statutes and the Constitution. And we have been successful showing that that has been damaging in our ability to protect our clean air and water, to protect our economy, and in this case, to protect our sailors. And the reason that we believe our chances are excellent is that Donald Trump asked the Congress repeatedly for dollars for this wall, and both Republicans and Democrats rejected that as a vanity project. It was really not a wise expenditure of dollars. And despite that, he went ahead and tried to ignore the clear law and the Constitution. And in our case, the impact in Washington state, and their impacts all over the country, but in our case, it is reducing the ability of the Navy to protect our nuclear submarines. Now, we have, if you see our nuclear submarines, our boomers, they're plying the waters of Puget Sound with ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons. And the Navy had an $80 million plus project to allow them to provide escort services to those subs and also improve oil prevention spill measures. And basically, Trump is trying to steal that for his vanity project on the southern border, even though the whole Congress denied him the right to do that, including the Republican Party.
I have all sorts of other difficult questions for you, so let me fire another one here. Your campaign, now that your campaign is over, what happens to the leftover campaign money? And will you use any part of that to reimburse the state for the cost of protecting you on the campaign trail?
Well, we're just closing out the campaign and paying our bills, and that's about it. There is funds that are returned for the general election that could not be used, and we're following the law on the Executive Protection Unit. The State Patrol provides executive protection by law for all governors, Republicans and Democrats. We're just going to follow that law. It was a pleasure to wave the Washington flag around the country, and I think it was helpful to raise the discussion level and the profile of the need to save our state and our nation from the ravages of climate change. So I won't be in the White House, but I think it was a productive enterprise, and now I'm really excited about the work I'm doing now and for governor, which I'd like to continue.
Well, let me throw a few things at you that I think your challengers will probably bring up then. The homelessness crisis. It does not seem to be going away. And one of the problems is, for people who are mentally ill, there seems to be no better option than to release them back onto the streets. And a lot of that is a state responsibility, isn't it?
Yes, and that's why we're reforming our mental health care system. It was gutted during the recession. During the recession, our capacity to provide mental health care for people was severely diminished. And we have been building up that capacity ever since. You know, everybody in their family has been touched by mental health service needs. And we know how debilitating these problems are. We know that people do get better if they get treatment, but we want them to get treatment where they live in their own communities. So we're changing the model to develop more community-based systems where people live close to their neighbors, their work, their churches, their families. And so we're in the process of making major modifications in this regard. The legislature did follow my lead and provide us additional resources last year to build that capacity, and we're in the process of doing that right now. But it is really important, I think, not to believe that mental health is the only challenge here. Look, over half of the people who are homeless are working, they're holding jobs, but they just can't pay their rent. And so we have to provide low-income housing for people in addition to those who don't have mental health challenges. And we have simply not provided enough housing for people, and we need to build more stock. We're doing that. Since I've been governor, we put in over $100 million pretty much every biennium and improving that. And now we have to do it as rapidly as possible. Just had a meeting with Mayor Durkin about including a shelter space so that we can get these folks housed as quickly as possible. We also need to have some criminal justice reform to divert people, to make sure that instead of ending up lodged in our jails, they get into a mental health facility and actually have housing that's a lot cheaper than housing people in jails. So we're in the midst of really reforming our system. It has a considerable way to go, but I think we're on the right path, and I'm eager to see that through.
Governor Jay Inslee, Governor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. The time is coming when your car is going to drive itself. But will you buy such a car? Will you feel secure in such a car? That's being studied now at the University of Washington. Don McKenzie is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering. And you came up with a study to try and assess just how people might accept the idea of sitting in a car without a steering wheel.
So we're really interested, looking ahead, how many people might use automated vehicles and how much more they might drive. So one of the things we know is the biggest cost to driving is the cost of the driver's time. And so if we free people up to do other things while they're traveling, then we would expect them to travel more. Basically, autonomous vehicles will make driving safer, cheaper, and more convenient. When you make something safer, cheaper, and more convenient, we expect people to do more of it. And we wanted to know how much more.
So you pulled it on the basis of price?
Yes. Yeah, so we ran an experiment where we asked people to make a hypothetical choice between driving themselves or riding in a ride-hailing car like Uber or Lyft. And in some cases, we told them that that ride-hailing vehicle was autonomous. And in some cases, we said it had a human driver. What we found is when it has a human driver, their cost of time goes down. So having someone else drive you is preferable to driving yourself. But when we said that it would be an autonomous car with a robot driving, the cost of their time went up.
Why? So in other words, they felt they were sacrificing more by driving in an autonomous vehicle?
We think right now, so many of these folks have probably never ridden in an autonomous vehicle. This is not really a technology that's out there on the mass market right now. People are probably skeptical of that technology. They would be a little apprehensive about getting into a car and turning over control to a robot. And so we think that that increase in the cost of time basically is a stress premium. It's the additional factor of...
So they felt that even with the autonomous vehicle, they would still feel obligated to pay attention to where they were going and be prepared to press the big red button?
Well, we don't know. We didn't dig in that deeply. We have some other work ongoing where we're getting a little more into the psychology of this. This is really important, though, because there are other people out there doing research right now, asking people how they feel about automated vehicles. And what people say they would do today doesn't necessarily reflect what we think they'd actually do in the future. Because, again, there's this skepticism, this nervousness, rightfully so, this lack of familiarity with this technology. Yeah, you don't really know.
So maybe once they see, because it's important, you don't want to invest billions into autonomous vehicles if nobody's going to use them.
Right. You know, there's this quote that I love from a Tesla customer talking about his autopilot system. He says, "It was the same distance, but the commute felt like it took half the time."
Uh-huh.
So when we have these partial automation systems, and the Tesla Autopilot is not a true driverless system,
right?
Even these partial automation systems, many people who use them love them, right? And as they become familiar with them, they really do embrace them and trust them and find them to be a great convenience.
Yeah. If you were assigning a personal cost to stress, which is how your study worked, right, I would think that driving your own car in Seattle traffic would pin the needle.
Right. So our sample was not just in Seattle. It was nationwide. And of course, most people don't like driving in traffic. I think even people who like driving don't like driving in traffic. We asked people, this was in the context of a 15-mile commute trip. What we found was the cost of their time was worth about $24 an hour. Mm-hmm. So basically, people would pay about $24 to save an hour of time. When we told them they'd be in an autonomous vehicle, that time went up to about $28.
Wow.
So that stress premium, they're saying
it's weird.
Riding in this car would actually be $4 worse. But again, we think in the future, if this technology takes off, if it proves viable commercially, it's going to be because people embrace it and learn and accept it. And so if that happens, we think that the way they'd behave in the future is more similar to how they would behave towards a ride-hailing car like an Uber or a Lyft today. You think about this, you know, being in a driverless car, it's a lot like being in an Uber or a taxi or a Lyft. You know, you don't have to drive. You don't have to search for parking. You just get in the car and tell it where to go. And you can do other productive or relaxing things along the way. You can eat, you can nap, you can catch up on email, you can game, whatever you want to do. And so we think that is probably more how people would respond in the future. And so that was kind of the twist in this study, is we used ride hailing services as this stand in for how we think people will respond to automated vehicles in the future. And that goes the other way. We find that their value of time goes down by about 13%. And if we point out to them, if we remind them, hey, you can do these other things, this multitasking,
then that, they feel better about it.
Yeah, it goes way down. And so we think it could translate to about between 5 and 20% more travel.
So once the autonomous vehicle marketing campaign kicks in, things should be fine.
What's really going to matter is the technology actually safe? And no amount of clever marketing is going to overcome a technology that doesn't work.
This idea of assigning a value to your commute time and that it's $24 an hour, that explains why the express toll lanes are popular, doesn't it?
People are willing to pay to save time. The single biggest cost of operating a vehicle is generally the cost of the driver's time.
Don McKenzie is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Washington, and he also leads the UW's Sustainable Transportation Lab. Don, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Don is a real traffic nerd, just like you, Chris. We spoke for like 25 minutes about this. And I even bounced all my ideas off him about, you know, making road reservations,
right,
like we did hotel reservations, and how to pay for it. And we put that all up on the Ross Files. Just Google Cairo Ross Files, and you'll find it right there. And you can just geek out on traffic research all you want.
And he nailed it. I mean, it's for me. I put myself in that study. And I like driving. I really enjoy driving. And the other one is I don't trust the technology.
Yeah.
And I hate giving up that control, because at least in an airplane, you know, you would expect the pilots, you know, you've got some other people there. Same with an Uber. You hope they'd be able to drive. But yeah, once you give up that control, I'm not ready for that.
Well, and a lot of people felt the same way.
Yeah.
We have talked for years about testing the huge backlog of DNA samples, and that process is finally underway. But there's been a little hiccup in it. And here's Kyrita's Hannah Scott.
So for years, Seattle has fought for a change in state law to get DNA samples tested for certain sex offenders and domestic abusers. They finally got that this year, and we just found out that some of those samples that they had, they've destroyed. We're talking about 107 DNA samples that SPD had in their evidence warehouse for years from people convicted, again, for misdemeanor sex and domestic violence crimes. We're talking about crimes like fourth-degree assault with sexual motivation, communicating with a minor for immoral purposes, harassment, stalking, indecent exposure, and violating a sexual assault protection order. All of those crimes, sexual assault survivors, prosecutors, and law enforcement say are vital to get DNA from offenders so it can be uploaded into the National Criminal Database, or CODIS, where it's used to test against other crimes and rape kits. All of that happens at the State Patrol Crime Lab, but it stopped accepting Seattle's DNA samples in 2014 for what basically amounts to a technical issue. The city's code didn't match the state code in the way that those crimes were described or referenced. The city kept collecting the samples anyway since 2014 and stored them. They pushed for the necessary change to state law for years and again got that this last session. After that, along with the city attorney Pete Holmes, city council member Lorena Gonzalez pushed the necessary legislation for the largely technical fix at the city level through just 2 months ago, stressing its importance.
To deal with both backlog issues related to our DNA samples, which in large part are related to, again, sex crimes. And we've heard pretty clearly from a lot of survivors in this area that this is an incredibly important step to move this public safety issue forward. It will allow the police department and other law enforcement agencies to use DNA evidence to solve crimes, catch perpetrators, and bring justice to victims and their families.
That passed in July, finally allowing SPD to send what now totaled 650 untested DNA samples to the state lab and finally get them into the system. But a problem. This week, SPD revealed 107 of those samples had been destroyed. Mayor Durkin asked about it yesterday.
Chief Best and I both were very dismayed that this happened. They were transferred from the King County system to the Seattle Police Department system. There wasn't the right paperwork in place. And for a series of circumstances that occurred, they were accidentally destroyed.
As for what the city's doing about it,
Chief Best did the absolute right thing. She contacted the inspector general and said, I want you to investigate to make sure that this never happens again. It's really unfortunate that it happened. We're investigating to determine what those samples reflected in terms of the types of offenders. And we're also putting in place the procedures we have to have in place to make sure that doesn't happen again.
But sexual assault survivor Leah Griffin, who fought to get the bill passed this year to clear our state's rape kit backlog, along with this bill to fix Seattle's DNA issues, tells Cairo 7 TV's Essex Porter the city needs to do more than just investigate.
These are known predators. They've been convicted of crimes. The police, if they wanted to put in the effort to really make this right, would go out and recollect that evidence.
From possibly finding a match to a rape kit to potentially solving a murder or cold case, Griffin says there's just too much at stake for the city to not go out and immediately recollect these samples. She's going to be pushing for that.
So they have the names of the people whose samples were destroyed. So they can go back and just collect. So this is just a matter of getting a hair follicle or something again.
It's a cheek swab. That's what they were to begin with. So they need to go out back out and recollect that cheek swab. I'm going to be checking to make sure that's legal to see if they can do that and whether they will do that. This is a big deal. You know, when this passed back in July, City Attorney Pete Holmes put out a statement and not only saying that, you know, this is really important to have these samples in the national system to match to things like rape kits, but that that DNA database is what has helped us solve some cold cases, the Golden State Killer, all of these things.
Why are we worried? They're obviously going to go back and do that. Are they or are they not?
We don't know. They're having the Office of
Inspector General. There's no law that says they can't go back and recollect the samples, is there?
Not that I'm aware of, but they have not come out and said that that's what they will do. So I will be checking.
Okay. Well, that seems a little strange to me.
Yeah, we'll see.
Kyrie, it is Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Tom Tiny is here. He's taking a break, staring out the window into the void of the cosmos, pondering existence. To ponder not just one movie, but two.
That's right, Dave. Two very different films open today. One is set in outer space in what's proclaimed the near future. The other in a plummy aristocratic English mansion nearly a century ago. Of course, I'm referring to Ad Astra, starring Brad Pitt as an astronaut on a deep space journey, and Downton Abbey, the much-anticipated cinematic follow-up to the acclaimed British TV series about an upper-crust family and its lower-class servants. Two movies have very different missions, but both, more or less, fulfill their basic calling. Neither is without flaws, however. The far more serious and ambitious film is Ad Astra. It may use the standard thriller plot device, humanity's very existence is at stake, but it treats it as an excuse to ruminate about life, as much as it uses it as a platform for acts of daring do. Put another way, it's much more a sci-fi version of Apocalypse Now than a futuristic Rambo. Now, Brad Pitt plays an astronaut who's sent out into space on a top-secret mission to save the world.
What can you tell us about the LIMA Project?
Its objective was to search for advanced extraterrestrial life. The ship disappeared approximately 16 years into the mission.
Your father was experimenting with a highly classified material that could threaten our entire solar system. We're counting on you to find out what's happening out there.
Pitt's mission is to save the universe, of course, but also to get Dad, who may or may not have gone rogue. See the Apocalypse Now connection. As he journeys from Earth to Moon, from Moon to Mars, and from Mars to the rings of Neptune, he has many harrowing encounters, including an ambush by terrorist moon buggies on the dark side of the moon, but none is more harrowing than the father-son dynamic on eventual display. Ad Astra is a strong, moody adventure film about space travel and its pitfalls. It's also about the pitfalls of family, and on that score, it's a little too explicit for its own good. Thanks to Pitt's voiceovers, this man of few words doesn't know when to shut up. In space, no one should hear you brood. And now, for a complete change of pace. I knew you'd know this, Dave.
Oh, yes. I got hooked on this for 3 years.
Yeah, me too. Fans will no doubt melt into their seats when they hear those familiar strains. That's the theme music of Downton Abbey. This new movie version of the hit TV series is strictly for its legions of fans, and yes, I consider myself one of them. The film makes no concessions to newcomers. You either know these characters or you don't. What makes it hard for the uninitiated is certainly not the ability to follow the storyline. It's as simple gets. It's just that it's not a very interesting plot for those with no predetermined love for the characters. The premise of the movie is that the King and Queen of England are visiting Downton Abbey for an overnight stay, and of course, the Crawley family and its downstairs staff is all a-twitter. Crises arise and are averted at a nice clip. Screenwriter Gillian Fellows deserves credit for crafting a script that allows for at least 20 cherished characters from the Downton Abbey household to deliver lines and still have enough space left over to introduce 5 new characters as well. But sometimes putting small screen material on the big screen exposes some of the weaknesses and flaws of the original material, and this is indeed true of Downton Abbey the movie. Even fans like me fully acknowledge some of the series' shortcomings. Ridiculously miraculous recoveries, melodramatic criminal matters, etc., etc. I see you nodding, Dave.
Yes, they were stretching it out.
Yes. Amidst the appealing historical context, the fascinating sociological strains, and the gossipy personal crises of the well-to-do Crawley family and its servants. It's just that the flaws were usually overwhelmed by the constant and rapid-fire developments of the hours and hours of programming made possible by long-form television. In a 2-hour film, the plot contrivances stand in starker relief. Even the famed witticisms of Maggie Smith's Countess of Grantham comes off as a little too staged for the film. But this is for all you fans out there.
Now, are you going to tell us about Lady Bagshaw? Is she a very distant cousin?
No, her father was my great-uncle.
Then why have I never heard of her?
Because she chose to cut herself off from the family.
Do you know the reason?
See, I believe she means to cheat your father of his rightful inheritance.
Plotting something. I see a Machiavellian look in your eye.
Machiavelli is frequently underrated. He had many qualities.
So did Caligula, not all of them charming.
What are you up to, Granny?
Well, ideally, I would like Maud to see your father as the son she never had.
Will she be the mother I never had?
Sarcasm is the lowest form of wit.
Likewise, one might say big-screen versions of top-drawer television shows are the lowest form of cinema, to which Downton Abbey fans might say, who cares?
That's what qualifies as stand-up, by the way, for Downton Abbey.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Can you go back to the rogue terrorist buggies on the back of the movie? Yeah. Where did they come from?
Scene. Well, the thing is, that's a really a great scene, because it's in the near future, but we've clearly colonized the moon, and at that point, they're also, it's kind of a satire, but it's like, yeah, you know, the dark side of the moon, it's like, they call it the Wild West out there, and it reminds me at times like of Syria, you know, at its worst, when there's like, you just have miles and miles of desert and no one in control. And so, yeah, there are pirates up there attacking the astronauts and everything
else.
It actually makes perfect sense.
It does make sense.
Yeah.
All right, so for the Tangs, how many Tangs for Ad Astra?
I'll give it 3 Tangs out of 4, Dave.
And Downton Abbey?
Downton Abbey, 2.5, unless you're a huge fan, and it'll be 3.5.
Thank you, Tom.
Bye-bye.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness now. A Kansas City man is shacking up with a shelter dog in an effort to get her adopted. Scott Poor says Queen, a 3-year-old terrier mix, has been living in a shelter for 400 days, the longest of any animal there.
I just can't figure out why she's not getting adopted.
Scott says she was found living behind a dumpster in a rough part of town before she was brought to the shelter, but says her early life has not affected her. She's a great dog. So, to bring attention to her, more exposure, he's decided to grab his pillow and blanket and his work computer and has now been living with Queen in her shelter space, in her little cage of sorts, although it's not a cage, and will stay there as long as it takes to get her adopted. He tells KMBC-TV the new living situation is loud.
Nothing quiet in this building. She does not snore, but I can hear other dogs in the building snore.
But he says it's all worth it to get Queen into her forever home.
She's just been slowly declining in the shelter environment. Queen is really speaking for all long-term shelter dogs.
And I'm sure many of you will say, why doesn't he adopt her? He's well aware that people want him to take Queen, but he has no plans to do so. He says, everybody wants me to, but I have a dog at home that's very special, and I bring a different dog every night to the shelter that he finds. He says, I'm in the business of exporting, not importing. In fact, he has a clothing business, and he creates T-shirts to bring attention to shelter dogs. So this is sort of his thing. He doesn't want to just keep taking in dogs. He wants you to help as well.
So how long has he been there so far?
Well, that's funny. I tried to find that answer. The article doesn't say, although the story ran on September 18th. So I think this is a new endeavor.
I see.
And he plans to be there as long as it takes. I just looked at the Great Plains shelter Facebook page to see, okay, with all this attention, has Queen been adopted? Yeah. I don't see that she has, but when she does, I'll let you know.
Okay.
It's time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And now here he is, Danny O'Neill. Big game with New Orleans, but no Drew Brees. And as I understand it, Danny, the backup quarterback is someone that New Orleanians don't even know.
Well, it's Teddy Bridgewater. The Seahawks actually faced him twice when he was with Minnesota. And do you remember the freezing cold game? The one that was so cold that players were feeling their fingers freeze?
Vaguely.
Well, he was the quarterback for the Vikings in that game. Since then, he suffered what was a career-changing knee injury. And that kept him out for all of two seasons. He's kind of reclaimed his career. He's become one of the league's very best backups. But nobody's really seen him play extended time since that freezing cold game. So Teddy Bridgewater has a lot to play for here. If he plays well in this interim while Brees is out, you're going to see teams that will spotlight him as their upcoming starting quarterback, a potential franchise quarterback. So I would not look past who Teddy Bridgewater is and what he's got to play for here. You also have to keep a good close eye on Taysom Hill. Taysom Hill is he's a versatile player who has been used as kind of a quarterback slash running back slash receiver. And he's someone I bet you'll see get about a dozen snaps for the Saints on Sunday.
So you're saying that this quarterback, unknown though he may be, has a really strong motivation to do something extraordinary on Sunday.
Not only that, but at one point he was identified as Minnesota's franchise quarterback. So he's got motivation. He's also got an incredible amount of talent. This is not someone who is sort of a complete unknown. The question about Teddy Bridgewater has always been, will he be able to sort of regain the momentum that he had built up when he was a young player before that knee injury? This is the dangerous opponent. And not only that, but New Orleans 10 years ago was built entirely around their quarterback. Well, they've actually got a really strong, they've got a very, very strong defense now and a physical run game. So this is, by no stretch of the imagination, should anybody consider this as going to be an easy game.
Okay, talking about defense, Ziggy Ansah is going to play on Sunday. Now, I forget, has he played before?
He has not. He's missed the first two games. Pete's been teasing us, tantalizing us with the possibility that he would play. He has not played. He's coming back from an offseason shoulder injury, or shoulder surgery, I should say. And the expectation is fully that he will be unleashed.
Okay. So he is a he's considered to be a peer of Jadeveon Clowney?
He is. And he was the guy that they actually sought out first before they knew they could get Clowney. So it's very exciting.
It is. So in other words, we got two really strong guys that we're not too familiar with, but could figure in this game very prominently.
Absolutely.
All right, so does that mean, and I've mentioned this before, does that mean that there's a scenario where Russell Wilson might have, you know, maybe more than half a second to get a pass off?
Well, that's going to depend on the offensive line. They're supposed to be better this year, Dave. That's what we were led to believe, right?
Right.
All of a sudden, they're giving up a ton of pressure. Don't expect him to have much time. Like, that's not going to be part of the equation because New Orleans can bring pressure. And Cam Jordan is one of the very best defensive ends in the entire league. So I would not expect this to be an easy game by any stretch, either for Seattle's defense or for Russell Wilson.
Okay, other injuries we should know about on the Hawks.
Well, you got to keep a good close eye on Ethan Posick and DJ Fluker. They both play the same position. They're right guards. Fluker left last week's game and suffered a little bit of an ankle injury. He was out on practice on Wednesday. He returned to practice to a limited extent yesterday. That's a really positive sign. And I think that Posick has had a sore neck. But I would keep a very, very close eye. Puna Ford should return this week, and that's good news. But you got to keep a close eye on the big guy, DJ Fluker.
I get DJ Fluker mixed up with DK Metcalf.
DK Metcalf could not be a more sculpted and physically impressive. He looks like Adonis.
Mm-hmm.
And DJ Fluker is massive. Like, he is huge. And I don't mean to be mean, but DK Metcalf has a six pack, mm-hmm. and DJ Fluker has a party ball.
Right. Well, but DJ Fluker is not supposed to have a six pack. He's supposed
to be
a steamroller, right?
He's not, but big guys can be sexy too, Dave. Look at the ESPN body issue. You got the Philadelphia offensive line. It's fantastic.
I missed the Philadelphia offensive line in the body issue. For some reason, that wasn't high on my priority of photographs to look at.
Oh, there's a whole lot of playground there, Dave.
No doubt about that. So are you willing to share with us your prediction for the outcome of Sunday's game?
Yes. Do you remember my prediction last week?
It was completely wrong.
It stunk. It was terrible. But the score was relatively close. I said 27-20, but I also
said
Pittsburgh.
But you got the winner wrong. Yeah.
I got the winner completely wrong. You didn't need to bring that up. It sounds like you're rubbing it in.
Would have lost a lot of money on that, even though the score was close.
Well, you shouldn't have lost a lot of money because it's illegal to bet on sports.
Well, of course.
In the state
I'm not going to bet on sports.
Good. Good. My prediction this game, purely for recreational purposes, Seahawks 24, Saints 16.
24-16.
That's correct.
Interesting.
It's going to be a little bit of a slobber knocker.
All right. I'm not putting money on it, but thank
Good.
You.
Good. All right.
The Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Thanks, Dave.
Are you an introvert or are you an extrovert? And what difference does it make? Let's Ask Allie with licensed mental health counselor Allie Sokolow, sponsored by Pro Club, the Northwest Premier Center for Health and Wellness. As it's been explained to me, Allie, an extrovert is someone who gets their energy by being in front of a lot of other people. An introvert gets their energy by being completely alone in the forest with just the birds chirping. Can you change who you are, or are you born that way?
I think you're born that way, and I think you're heavily influenced by what you do all day. So I would say that I don't know if I was born an introvert or an extrovert, but talking to people all day in counseling has made me more of an introvert.
Really?
Yes.
So you prefer to be alone?
I prefer.
So no group sessions for you?
No group sessions for me. Thank you. Yes.
Now, does that dictate, for example, your choice of partner, your choice of jobs, how you raise your children? I mean, what's affected by that?
Good question. So I wouldn't say it changes the way you look for a partner or look for a job, but it changes the way you deal with the other part of your life when you're surrounded by people who are a different personality than you. So I am an introvert. My husband's an extrovert. And so I come home, I'm depleted, I need a break from people before I can be social again. And there has to be that understanding in the relationship because he could go hang out with people 24 mm-hmm. hours a day.
Yeah. What if you're the type who really wants to entertain, but you're an introvert and or you are married to an introvert who doesn't really enjoy it?
So I like to call myself and those types of people that you're describing an outgoing introvert.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not shy. I like people, obviously, or I wouldn't be a counselor. I like to be around people, but I do get my energy drained from that. And so I have to make sure that I put time in my schedule to just be alone so that I can go back out in the world and be around people. So like how you navigate that in a relationship is my husband knows that like, on Friday night, if he wants to go out and be around people, it's going to be solo because I can't do it.
Hmm. And so that's okay, huh?
That's
you say, you go to the party, I'm going to sit home and read.
Absolutely.
Really?
Yeah. And those are sort of rules we've established over the years, right? And so he knows. But Saturday night, I'm better. I've had 24 hours to sort of detox from people.
And he's okay with that? He doesn't call you a party pooper?
I mean, it wasn't easy at first.
Yeah.
But then he understood my personality and I understand him. Like I have to understand that it's not about him not wanting to be at home with me. It's just that he needs to be around people to feel good. Yeah.
Now, for extroverts, do they sometimes go too far? I mean, you know, not understand that there might be people in their group of friends who can't be on all the time.
For sure. And I think vice versa. It's not only the extrovert's fault, right? It's mm-hmm. also the introvert. It's, you know, I think that what we have to understand about people is that everybody has a limit for what they can handle. And so if you can sort of get to know the people around you and understand like, hey, they're not just blowing me off. They really need a legitimate break on a Friday night or a Saturday night. And then they're awesome when they come out after that.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really about understanding your friends.
So then this is not like other things like a fear of spiders, which you can cure over time. What you have to do is figure out who you are, who your partner is, who your friends are, and make room for that, sounds like.
Absolutely. I think we should embrace who we are. I think introverts don't like to admit they're introverts because I think that there's some stigma attached to that they're antisocial, and that's not true. I think I'm really social. I talk to people all day long. But it's where my energy lies, and I need a break at the end of the day, whereas extroverts can keep on going.
Hmm. I would think this would be important to understand if, for example, you're a teacher in a classroom full of kids.
Absolutely, because there's nothing wrong with a kid that's just taking a break on the playground and not hanging around a bunch of kids, right? They may actually need that. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with the teenager that stays home on Friday night. It doesn't mean that they don't have friends at school. It's about understanding where they're at mentally and how exhausted they are.
So what you don't do is say, hey, why don't you go out tonight?
Yes.
Why aren't you with your other friends?
Because it puts a lot of pressure on people who don't understand who they are.
Hmm. Allie Sokolo, licensed mental health counselor. Ask Allie. Thank you, Allie.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.